This is an ABC podcast.
Hello from David Rutledge. Welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. And I want to begin this week by asking you, how easy to understand do you think philosophy should be? Or maybe putting it another way, how clear and precise and unambiguous do you think the style of philosophy should be? Up until a certain point in the 20th century, most people's answer to that question would have been quite unequivocal. Put very simply, the goal of philosophy was generally held to be truth. Philosophers wanted to get to the essence of things, to figure out exactly what it means to talk about the self or humanity or being or good and evil. And so the language of philosophy was supposed to be as lucid and rigorous as possible, so as to leave as little room as possible for misinterpretation. And if that made philosophy difficult to understand, it was only because the language and the terminology in play were highly specialized, almost like a technical language in science. Well, this week, we're going to be hearing about a moment in the not-so-distant past when those philosophical values came up against a profound challenge, and it was a challenge that philosophy is still coming to grips with today. A new way of doing philosophy emerged in France following the end of the Second World War, and it involved such figures as Georges Bataille, Jacques Derrida, Michel Foucault, Luce Irigaray, Jean Baudrillard, Gilles Deleuze, and a number of others whose work often gets bundled together in terms like postmodernism or post-structuralism. And there are two things that everybody knows about these philosophers. One is that they're really hard to read, and the other related thing is that philosophical traditionalists often really, really hate them. And the antipathy has precisely to do with those age-old philosophical values of clarity and lucidity, which these modern French theorists seem to have completely thrown out the window. Anybody who's ever read the early work of Jacques Derrida will know exactly what I'm talking about. The text bristles with abstruse wordplay and double meanings and obscure references, and he never seems to land on a point. It's all questions and riddles and deflection. And this has led a great number of philosophers to conclude that Derrida is not really one of them at all, but some sort of clown poet figure posing as a philosopher. Well, today we're taking up this question of how clear and unambiguous philosophy is supposed to be, the question of style in philosophy, and looking at how this extraordinary moment in 20th century French intellectual history sent shockwaves through the profession that are still reverberating. My guest is Jessica Marion. She's a postdoctoral research fellow in the School of Culture and Communication at the University of Melbourne. Let's start with this period in France, the aftermath of World War II, where we see a profound shift in philosophy taking place, and this is the emergence of completely new ways of thinking and writing. And I want to ask you, before we get into the details of this new philosophy, what do you think is animating the change? Because we have seen a similar thing happen at the end of World War I, certainly in the arts, where you had movements like Dadaism and Surrealism emerging as a response to the madness that Europe had just put itself through then. Is this the kind of thing that you see taking place in philosophy in France after World War II, almost like a kind of trauma response?
Absolutely. I think after the Second World War, the Holocaust, obviously, and also the occupation of France, there's definitely a shift in aesthetic and philosophical perception, I think. In France, immediately after the liberation of Paris, a thing that's not super well known, but there were trials of citizens accused of treason and crimes of collaboration. It was described as a purge. And alongside the obvious, like, political, military, bureaucratic figures that you would expect that to include, it also included writers who had supported collaboration. And in fact, they were some of the first people to go on trial. So I think there was immediately a thinking around the culpability and ethics of writing, the power of writing in the world. And so there were intellectual debates, like quite heated intellectual debates about what is the proper punishment for these writers. And I think that seems really kind of bizarre and alien to us today, almost like I could not imagine that happening. And writers were executed as punishment for for collaboration in writing. And so you can imagine the stakes in the wake of that. The other thing, of course, is that a lot of the central figures you're thinking of that were really active in the interwar period reemerged after the Second World War. So figures like Georges Bataille, who I think we'll talk a bit about today, he was really involved in Surrealism in the 30s and 40s, and particularly like the political side of Surrealism. But then after World War II, he moves in a really different aesthetic and intellectual direction. So, yeah, I think there was a certain shift in philosophic perception after World War II. And this did lead to like a kind of grand era of French philosophy in the second half of the 20th century.
Well, we see the emergence of a new style in philosophical writing that completely severs itself from earlier philosophical styles. How would you describe this stylistic rupture? What's going on exactly?
One of my first kind of motivations with coming to research the style of French theory, which was sort of like the motivating question of my doctoral research, is that it, like the style of that era is that it's one of those ideas that sort of precedes the work, the thinkers, like before you've even read a single text by someone like Jacques Lacan or Jacques Derrida or Lucien Grey, you might hear that their writing or their style is infamously difficult or impossible to read. So it's something that a lot of people feel like hate, I would say, towards. But it is also something that's been celebrated, of course, that, yeah, a generation of French thinkers invented a new way of creating prose, sort of like completely original theoretical idiom. The style is like something I think that's really hard to speak about with precision. Definitely there's a playfulness in the period, a willingness to engage in wordplay and a kind of pleasure taken in wordplay. Things like puns, obviously, anecdotage, these sorts of things. Complex syntax, I guess those are some of the ways you would describe it. But one feature I have focused on a lot in my research is a kind of ventriloquism, I would call it. So it's like a style of writing where the different voices get confused or mixed up. And so it leads to what I've described as like a sort of impersonal style. You don't really have a strong or concrete philosophical voice. There's this constant melding and switching between and taking on other people's voices. My colleague Joe Hughes has a magnificent description of this as a kind of free and direct discourse. And that's a literary technique that's usually associated with novelists like Jane Austen, Virginia Woolf, D.H. Lawrence. And that's where the author gives the reader an unmediated access to the consciousness of the of a particular character, usually the main character. And that happens through a blurring of first and third person. And so I think this sort of philosophical equivalent of this is when you might be reading and there's a difficulty to tell, okay, am I reading what this philosopher thinks, or are they pre-seeing or ad-libbing in the voice of the philosopher that they're supposedly making a commentary about? So someone like Maurice Blanchot, the mid-century philosopher critic who really influenced more famous figures like Jacques Derrida or Emmanuel Levinas, he has a real penchant for ventriloquizing or speaking in the voice of someone that he's supposed to be doing a philosophical commentary on. So it's like he'll put on the voice of Heidegger, for example. And this really happens in the genre of the review.
Right. Yeah, we'll talk about the review in a sec. I mean, that's very interesting. But is it a case of, okay, we're doing philosophy, but we're just doing it in a new style? Or is it also a sort of a transformation of the concepts as well? So it's not just the old philosophy in new clothes. It's an entirely new philosophy that requires the new style.
Yeah, I think that's right. And there's an attention to new questions as well that tend to be highly metaphilosophical. So questions about the meaning of meaning, you know, or off the back of something like structuralism, it's like, okay, what is the function of writing and science in the world? So different questions are definitely being interrogated as well.
Yeah. So when you talk about this displacement of old philosophical forms and the creation of new ones, are we seeing philosophers, either consciously or otherwise, looking to other forms of writing, like poetry, for example? Because I understand that a lot of the poetry being produced in France at that time was deeply influenced by philosophy. You had existentialist poets, phenomenological poets. Were the philosophers being influenced in turn by the poets in terms of style?
That's an interesting question. It makes me think of someone like Jean-Paul Sartre, who really melds those two identities, the creative writer and the philosopher, and that there is really no boundary between those two for him. Maurice Blanchot is another person like that. You have so many thinkers who are also writers. Even when you have a thinker, someone like Derrida, who doesn't, he never produces a novel, for instance, or publishes a book of poetry, there's an interest in being writerly, I think, because definitely those boundaries become much more fluid, I think, that it's an intellectual scene where all different types of intellectuals, I guess, are mixing together, informing each other, reading each other. It's a really sort of rich and diverse intellectual scene.
And a lot of this new and radically different philosophy, as you've mentioned, is being done in a rather unexpected literary form, and that's the review. Philosophers reviewing the work of other writers in review journals. What is it about the review form that lends itself to the experimental stylistic approach that these philosophers are taking?
People were definitely writing book reviews before the war, but I would argue that it sort of exploded in the post-war period, and that it's actually the sort of unacknowledged central genre of post-war French thought. It's funny because it's obviously considered to be a minor form of intellectual activity. You don't think of a philosopher's most famous works. You don't think of their book reviews. But it was really, really ubiquitous. A lot of people came up through their doctoral research and beyond, and some of the first publications they made were book reviews. And there were many, many, many outlets for this type of work. So those journals, I think, became like really important scenes of production and dissemination. I think the review form is, I guess, sort of well suited, I think, to becoming a sort of like experimental form, partly just because it's like as simple as that it's short. And so people can be really prolific in that genre. But the thing I would point to as really crucial is that you don't usually review old texts. So they're motivated by a response to like your immediate present. So you review a book that came out last month or 6 months ago, not something that came out 100 years ago. And if you are writing about something from 100 years ago, it's because it's just been released in a new translation or a press has reissued that work. So there's always this like immediacy and closeness and situatedness. And so, yeah, because book reviewing became incredibly ubiquitous and there were so many outlets for that work, I think some stuff started happening in the form.
Right. And so this is what you mean when you say that philosophical commentary begins to be marked by a strong situational consciousness. Is that that sort of currency, that immediacy you're talking about, that philosophy is engaged right within the contemporary critical scene?
Yeah, exactly. You get a sense, I think, of the milieu in which the ideas are being produced and pursued. When you start thinking about the work in this way, I think you get a better sense of like audience. That the review is like the scene of production for a lot of this, you know, new experimental philosophical work. In part, it kind of explains why it might be difficult to read, because for us, 50 years later, reading in a different language in Australia, that context has totally fallen away. And especially a lot of these reviews get republished and those collected essays become the kind of canonical version of these works. But they're not explicitly framed as a review anymore. But the edits might only be very minor. They might just change the first paragraph. But suddenly now I don't know, okay, this was actually a review of this book that had come out 3 months earlier. And that book that's been reviewed is kind of totally irrelevant now. It's never been translated. I've never read it. I've never even heard of the author. So the works are being produced with this like really strong sense of situation. But then, yeah, of course, for us reading in a new context, that milieu falls away. And reconstructing the scene of production is really time-consuming, and it doesn't present itself to us.
There were a great many periodicals operating in France after the war. I mean, you're focusing on one of them, which is Critique, which was founded by Georges Bataille and Pierre Prévost in 1946, still going today. What is it about Critique for you that's particularly drawn your attention?
Yeah, so you're right. There were many, many, many journals that were providing an outlet for this short format work. I have focused really closely on this journal Critique, founded by Bataille, as you say. A lot of them pop up immediately after the war, like an astonishing number of new journals pop up. Ones that might be more familiar is something like Le Temps Moderne, which is founded by Jean-Paul Sartre, or something like Tel Quel. People might have heard of those. So it was a really saturated field of journals. Most of the journals articulate their alignment or their ideological position in the field quite explicitly. I mean, Critique did that too, but it did it by saying that it was going to be totally apolitical. And so it set itself apart in a number of ways from the other agents in the field. One of the things that's specific and important about Critique, especially for me given my interest in the review, is that they only published review essays. From the very beginning, that was declared in the sort of founding documents. So there's no occasional essays, there's no op-eds, there's no creative works, which a lot of the journals would publish creative work alongside critical work. Critique is like, absolutely not. So it became pretty much immediately a quite an important, well-regarded place to publish. I'm interested in it as well because it had an incredibly illustrious editorial board. At one point in the 60s, Roland Barthes, Michel Foucault, and Jacques Derrida were all on the editorial board at one time. And you don't even hear about that in, you know, in quick discussions of their life work. You never hear, oh, they were editing a journal with their, you know, fellow superstar philosopher academics. And as you said, it's still published today, so it's definitely stood the test of time. So yeah, I guess I'm interested in it because it's really explicit about prioritizing the review form. And one of the things Bataille and Prévost do, they produce a series of documents at the founding that sort of set out the goals of the journal, and they advertise it as well. It's the way they announce the journal to the field. Bataille says to the publisher that he's trying to get on board with the project, I'm taking the reviews of Maurice Blanchot as my model, and this is the type of work we really want to publish. And so, as I said before, like Blanchot is someone who innovates this like depersonalized, indirect ventriloquism style of philosophy. And so for the journal, for a specific journal to set that as their model and their ideal and their agenda, I would argue that sort of like institutionalizes that practice. You know, now it's no longer tied to one specific author and that's his style. This is actually like the house style of the journal. And so as the journal's reputation and kind of influence grows, so too does the influence of this particular idealized style.
Right. And one of the things that you've, an interesting point you make about the review form in your thesis is that it places the philosopher critic in a particularly close relationship to an other. What are you getting at exactly there? And what's the significance of that?
It's partly tied to this idea about being really situated, but I would say it means philosophy immediately is not an abstract discourse in this scene. You're not writing just a philosophical reflection on whatever concept or question. You're actually engaging with a really specific interlocutor and you have someone in mind. So often in this scene, it's someone you might know personally, or you might know someone who knows them, or you might see them au café. I'm exaggerating, but you get the point. Like it's, you know, they know who they're writing about. They know who their mentors are. So there's this kind of like really specific relationship to a really particular other that becomes central to the way the ideas are formulated. And so I think it's like not shocking when you have that in mind to see the emergence of these different types of indirection or styles of impersonality where your critical voice and position taking merges with a text that's under review that is really definite and really close.
On Radio National and ABC Listen, this is The Philosopher's Zone. With me, David Rutledge, my guest this week is Jessica Marion from the School of Culture and Communication at the University of Melbourne. Well, I think there are going to be listeners who are taking in all of this history with great interest and appreciation, but who are also thinking that, you know, okay, so that's how the style of all this impossible French philosophy developed, but I still hate the style and we need to talk about that. And as you point out, you know, the style is highly divisive. What is it about style that polarizes in this way?
That's partly why I'm really interested in style, because it produces these incredibly strong responses. I understand that people, you know, can feel alienated by it, especially students. Like, I have to confess, when I first read Derrida as an undergrad, I really loved it. But I've been in the position now of teaching something like Derrida, and I get that not everybody reacts that way. And sometimes students just feel overwhelmed or alienated, or they feel that the work is elitist because it doesn't just present itself to their comprehension. But I would say, even though I think obviously the style has a purpose, and I think it does, it makes a definite intervention in a field. So you can't just say that the style is merely superfluous or that it doesn't have any sort of reason to support its existence. So even though I think that the style has a purpose, I don't think it's like the only way these ideas can be expressed. So one strategy I use in class is to, you know, read a challenging passage with the students and then just ask, like, how do we restate or paraphrase that idea and just say it out loud? And you can say back these ideas, you can rewrite them, but it doesn't stop there. Once you've done that, that enables us to go back to the text and consider how the idea was I guess, syntactically passed or unfolded? And what does that mean for the idea? You know, we now understand the core idea. We can go back and think about the kernel of that idea and how is it being passed out to us? Why is there a folding back on itself? What does that presentation mean for the concept?
In your thesis, you cite the Italian historian Carlo Ginzburg, who said that style functions as an instrument of both inclusion and exclusion. And I think that's a really important point. And this is something that people perceive when they encounter a very sort of opaque, difficult style, that there are people who get this and there are people who don't. And it's almost like there's a sort of a, well, I wouldn't say a moral distinction between them, but, you know, some sort of, it means something if you're, you know, if you're on the outside. It causes a certain kind of resentment. It's almost like the people who get this are like the intellectual elites. I mean, maybe that's what's going on. It's a perception of elitism.
Yeah, I understand that. I mean, I would hope that learning about some of the intellectual and institutional histories around post-war French thought would make people think again about that idea. I do think style has this inclusion-exclusion function, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's elitist. It means it's including a particular milieu, which is just a simple like way of saying that those French theorists were writing for the French scene, and it doesn't mean they're being obscure or difficult for the sake of alienating me, do you know? You know, I think filling out that scene, trying to reconstruct that, should, I think, make us pause about the assumption that this is targeted at alienating me.
Yeah, it's not about you.
I don't think it's elitist that I was not a French woman in 1968 at the École Normale Supérieure. Like, I can still read this work. It's just not directed at me. And it's definitely not refusing to communicate with me. It's just that it does belong to a scene. And I don't think that's like, there's no inherent morality to that one way or another. Like, I understand the reaction, but I think I would hope that, yeah, thinking about the intellectual history and the institutional history, filling out that scene should make us think again about exclusion and inclusion.
Mm. But I think there's a broader point to be made here. It's a point that people do often make about just what philosophy is supposed to be, you know, what sort of language philosophy is supposed to be couched in. And of course, you know, famously in 1992, when the University of Cambridge was proposing to confer an honorary degree on Jacques Derrida, a number of outraged academics wrote an open letter to the London Times, and they said that Derrida's work does not meet accepted standards of clarity and rigor, and that he's made a career out of translating into the academic sphere tricks and gimmicks similar to those of the Dadaists or of the concrete poets. Now, you could say, well, that's just reactionary conservatism speaking, but do you think that there is a point there somewhere about the need for clarity and rigor in philosophy, and that if you don't have that, then you might be doing poetry, you might be doing some sort of experimental essayism, but it's not philosophy?
Yeah. The Cambridge affair is so funny. They also describe the work as ugly. So I think it's very interesting, the slippage from a demand for clarity and rigor to a whole series of other judgments. I would love to have a knee-jerk reaction and say, yep, the Cambridge affair was just a conservative attack on Derrida and post-structuralism. But given the way I've tried to approach post-war French theory, it would probably be more reasonable for me to try to think about the institutional frames. So to try to like bring my own approach to critique and the review form to that scandal. So I guess like if I think about what frames are available, it happens in 1992 in England, it's off the back of the Thatcher era, the businessification of universities. It's framed by, of course, like longstanding philosophical disagreements between like English empiricist philosophy and continental French or German traditions, etc. Like if we think critically about that demand, it actually quickly slips into a sort of range of unspoken assumptions, maybe about the task and value of the humanities. I think like charges that this writing is bad or ugly or unrigorous, for sure they assume that clarity and transparent meaning should be the norm in humanities discourse. But like, you know, doesn't that assume that the humanities are just simply about communicating information in a plain way, just about cultural objects? So we're just describing something that immediately presents itself. And, you know, this is a humanity-specific problem. Like, nobody makes these demands of research and scholarly writing in fields like, I don't know, science or engineering. Like, that research is totally impenetrable to a non-specialist. So if you're making this demand for clarity and rigor, you're actually also making a demand for the humanities to just be, you know, about the plain transmission of information. And actually nobody thinks that about the humanities. And rightly, right? I'm one of these people that thinks the humanities has an inherently critical project. We hear about critical thinking all the time as like the most important thing a humanities education can impart. So I think we should be thinking differently about difficulty if we agree that the humanities is supposed to be critical. One of the rigorously argued tenets of, I guess, capital T theory or continental philosophy, I think, and this is, you know, this is an oversimplification of the claim, but it's the idea that the way we describe our world shapes our world. So if that's your argument, then actually it makes complete sense that genuinely critical thought would, I guess, call attention to its own writing through things like style and syntax that make the reader slow down and not simply absorb information, but rather think, digest, process. So I guess it's just the idea that passing through what is difficult or unfamiliar is actually an essential part of critical thinking. And so I think, you know, when people just make this demand, Derrida needs to just be more simple. It's terrorist obscurantism. That's something that's been, he's been accused of, terrorist obscurantism. It's like, what are you actually saying, you know, not just philosophy, but humanities work should be doing? It should just be plain, clear transmission of obvious things. And it's like, when you get to that level, nobody thinks that. And nobody would defend that argument, I think. So it's about following the slippage from one demand to what it implies in an unspoken way about, you know, a wider discourse about the value of the humanities.
But if what we're talking about here is the opinion that the experimental style in philosophy is some sort of offence against the plain transmission of information, what about the way in which the plain transmission of information can be seen as an offence against the experimental style? I guess what I'm thinking of here is the many commentaries on, you know, Derrida, Bataille, all the other highly experimental philosophers that try to explain the ideas in plain English terms. Because if it's true that the radical style is crucial to the ideas and the ideas can't be separated from the style, then is a plain English interpretation, like a kind of Derrida 101 approach, is that inevitably going to misrepresent the ideas and even do them some sort of interpretive violence?
I definitely would not defend the position that I think to be like a good critic or scholar of someone like Derrida, you need to be writing in a Derridean idiom. I don't think that's going to help anybody. I mean, that is a Derridean argument. The context is not, you know, determining. So that work, you know, even though I've been interested in kind of reconstructing the contemporary milieu around that work that sort of to some degree explains some of the stylistic abnormalities or idiosyncrasies, you know, I'm a good Derridean and I get that language is presented in the face of the generalized absence of a specific audience or readership. So, you know, even though I would insist that the style has a purpose, it's not simply an accessory. You know, I think that work clearly has circulated far beyond the sort of semi-closed milieu that I've investigated. And that means you can put these ideas in other words. You can say it more clearly, but you just don't stop there. Once you feel that you've understood the idea, then you can go back and look again at how that idea is passed out syntactically, or what is that illusion doing, bringing to mind this third idea that seemingly wasn't relevant, or why is he making a pun on this particular word and drawing our attention to the etymology of that particular word? You know, I don't think you can cut the style off, but I think you can break it down and separate those components of the thinking out and then kind of reorganize them for yourself to build understanding. And that's the critical thinking that we love.
So if we take a text like Derrida's Of Grammatology, which you mentioned earlier, that's his 1967 text, One of the main themes in that book is the indeterminacy of language and the impossibility of ever being able to arrive at any kind of fixed or authoritative meaning via language, because indeterminacy and slippage are sort of coded into the DNA of language itself. And the style of writing in the book enacts this impossibility, which makes it a tough read. But if Derrida is correct in what he's saying about language here, and I think he is, then is it the case that the language of traditional analytic philosophy, which tries to be as determinate as possible and tries to eliminate ambiguity and uncertainty, is it possible that that style of writing is actually inadequate in its own way to expressing truths about the world, if that's what we think philosophy is supposed to be doing?
I guess I would have to hedge and give a kind of partial answer. Like, I think I fully agree with Derrida that that set of assumptions about language and its relation to the world entails a certain blindness that limits it. But on the other hand, I would also have to say, like, those thinkers are writing for an audience in which those assumptions are shared, and that, you know, that work is still productive and sound within that frame. So it's, you know, I don't think we can, I would never totally dismiss it because it's not reflexive enough about its language. I can critique it from that perspective for sure. You know, but that doesn't, by making that critique, I haven't overwhelmed that work or decisively disproven its value. And that's the type of inverse argument people are trying to make about Derrida et al. It's like, if I can point to, you know, something that doesn't appear to me or make sense, that means the thought is totally irrelevant. It's like, no, like, all of these people are operating within specific intellectual fields where there are norms of, like, academic judgment, scholarly expression, in which the work is legible. And so I personally don't love analytic philosophy, but, you know, I don't refute its efficacy in its own scholarly context, if that makes sense.
Jessica Marion, she's a postdoctoral research fellow in the School of Culture and Communication at the University of Melbourne. More details on the Philosopher's Zone website, where you can also hear an extended version of this conversation. You can also hear the extended version on the Philosopher's Zone podcast. And of course, the best way to get your hands on that is via ABC Listen, which is your one-stop shop for this program and all of the other great ABC radio shows and podcasts. And while you're there, check out the extensive back catalogue of Philosopher's Zone episodes. They go back several years, so if you like what we're doing, there's a whole lot more of it waiting to be discovered. And I'm David Rutledge. Thanks for your company this week, and I hope you can join me again next time. Bye for now.